morning, council. Please call a case.
Case number 2731, Donna Zane versus the Lady School Fire Insurance Company. Project for felony, Ward, which is local. Project for felony versus the, also here for felony, Jeffrey Cormier, argument on the merits.
Council ready to proceed. Proceed, please.
Mr. Chief Justice, honorable members of the court, good morning. My name is Ward Fujimoto, and I'm appearing on behalf of petitioner, defendant, and appellant, Liberty Mutual Fire Insurance Company. The circuit court in this case ruled that Liberty Mutual would have been entitled to an offset in its capacity as underinsured motorist insurance carrier. And if it would please the court, I would like to use the abbreviation UIM insurance carrier for the sake of brevity. And the circuit court ruled that Liberty Mutual would have been entitled to an offset in credit but for its consent to settlement. And the court, although the circuit court's decision was less than clear, I believe that the plaintiff responding below argued it as a estoppel issue. And that is the way that it was decided in the ICA's decision in this case. And that was actually the narrow issue that was before the ICA on this appeal, because the plaintiff appellee did not file a cross appeal as to the first half of the ruling, that is, that Liberty Mutual would have been entitled to the credit but for the estoppel. In Taylor versus Geico, this court decided that a consent to settlement would waive subrogation rights. It did not decide that it would waive any other rights other than subrogation rights. For example, it did not decide that it would waive coverage defenses, and in this case would submit that a finding that a waiver of an offset occurs by a consent to settlement misconstrues the very nature of a consent to settlement and is also contrary to the Taylor versus Geico decision. We cited to the lower court and to the ICA case authority standing for the proposition that a consent to settlement does not waive coverage defenses, and more specifically, does not waive rights to an offset. Specifically, those cases were the Liberty Mutual Insurance Company versus Stalter case, the Fickbaum versus St. Paul insurance case, and a Safeco Insurance Company versus Woodley case, which are the cases that stand for the proposition that a consent to settlement in and of itself does not create a waiver of rights, it does not create an estoppel of rights, other than subrogation. And I would also note that Respondent Zane did not cite any contrary case authorities as to the estoppel issue, either before the circuit court below or in their appellate briefing on this appeal. And neither does the ICA decision cite any case specifically on point that a consent to settlement in and of itself can give rise to a waiver or an estoppel. So in that sense, the ICA's decision in this case is unprecedented. We also pointed out in the circuit court and before the ICA that a finding of estoppel in this case would be inconsistent with the record. Specifically, we introduced a declaration of Liberty Mutual Claims Representative Colin Chang, which detailed how he communicated 2 weeks after the initial consent to settlement, but a few months before the finalization of the Daimler-Chrysler settlement, that there was this decision in Government Insurance Company, Government Employees Insurance Company versus Daisal, that stood for the proposition that a UIM carrier can claim an offset not only for amounts available from a defendant driver, but also from all joint tortfeasors. In the Geico versus Daisal case, the joint tortfeasor was a dram shop defendant. And so Mr. Chang communicated that to Ms. Kawatachi of plaintiff's counsel's office and specifically detailed that. There was some initial confusion in that regard, in the sense that since there were so many decisions in the Geico versus Daisal case, there was initial confusion as to which opinion what Mr. Chang was referring to. He was in fact referring to the most recent opinion at that time, which was at that point a few months old. Ms. Kawatachi initially looked at an earlier decision in the Geico versus Daisal line of cases. And so I also would note for that in the circuit court, hearing below, and the transcript, I believe, would support this, that I offered to plaintiff's counsel the opportunity to present a countervailing affidavit or declaration from Ms. Kawatachi to disclaim or deny that that conversation took place. At the hearing, Mr. Sakuda declined that opportunity, so I would submit that if, in fact, that the conversation did not happen, and if, in fact, there are any genuine issues as to whether that conversation happened, then I would submit that they would have put in a declaration to that effect in the circuit court below. That did not occur.
Mr. Fujimoto, is it your position that Liberty Mutual should have been granted summary judgment at the circuit court level?
That's correct, Your Honor. It is.
In other words, it's your position that there was no genuine issue of material fact?
That is correct. Yeah, we would submit, and specifically because, number one, as a matter of law, a consent to settlement in and of itself cannot give rise to an estoppel as to an offset or other coverage defenses other than the right to subrogation, because a consent to settlement by definition only waives subrogation rights, nothing else.
Assume that that's true. Was there a genuine issue of material fact within the four corners of the record as it had been developed up to that point as to whether in its communications with the plaintiff's counsel, Liberty Mutual essentially entered into a meeting of the minds with the plaintiffs, or at least acquiesced with the plaintiffs with respect to the proposition that the plaintiff's settlement with Daimler Chrysler would not be considered for purposes of computing the Taylor gap.
I would submit there's absolutely no evidence in the record of any sort of acquiescence in that regard. In fact, the record is to the contrary, in that Mr. Chang clearly communicated it as early as January 8th of 2002 in intent to rely upon offsets due to the amounts foregone from Daimler Chrysler.
Doesn't Mr. Young's affidavit at least generate a question of fact with respect to that?
Not on that point. Not on the point that the intent to rely on that offset was communicated to the counsel. Mr. Young's affidavit addresses more general and procedural issues. In other words, that there was a request for the policy. And I might add, to this date, neither Liberty Mutual nor my office has ever received a copy of the Daimler Chrysler settlement agreement, even though it was requested back in 2002.
Let me read to you from a small portion of the Young affidavit. Had Liberty Mutual reneged on its consent and denied benefits at any time, he, and by that presumably he means the plaintiffs, would not have proceeded with the liability settlement. What does that mean to you?
That was the question that was raised by the circuit court judge below too. And I believe her exact question was, what other thing could it mean other than a right or a waiver of the right to an offset? I would submit, again, a consent to settlement, and in other words, raising coverage defenses is not reneging a consent to settlement, because a reneging of the consent to settlement would be, I intend to assert subrogation rights against Daimler Chrysler, therefore you need to communicate that to Daimler Chrysler, therefore that settlement cannot go forward. That did not occur in this case, because in Taylor versus Geico, this court made it abundantly clear that it wanted UIM insurers to consent to settlements. I think more recently it reinforced that point in the Granger versus Geico decision very strongly in telling UIM insurers, if you don't consent to settlement, you got to buy the claim. And so in that respect, Your Honor, and in response to the court's question, I believe that the record is inconsistent with the proposition that, for one, reneging on a consent would somehow waive the offset.
Let's hold that phrase aside for just a second and read Mr. Young's statement this way, because I think it's arguably a fair reading. Had I understood at any time that Liberty Mutual was going to deny benefits, UIM benefits, I would not have proceeded with the liability settlement. Now, if that's a fair reading of Mr. Young's statement, does that generate any issues of material fact?
No, it does not, because it does not establish any, number one, affirmative representation from Liberty Mutual that it would not deny UIM benefits. There's no evidence that Liberty Mutual had agreed to settle any UIM claim up to that point in the time frame of Mr. Young's affidavit, number one. Number two, any such reliance would have been unreasonable in light of the Geico versus Daisal decision, because once Mr. Chang communicated that, and yes, he did not communicate it to Mr. Young, however, the contact person at that point had been Ms. Denise Kawatachi. And again, the plaintiff's counsel, as I understand it, at all relevant times, Ms. Kawatachi was with the plaintiff's counsel's office. I would submit that if the conversation did not occur, it would have been relatively easy for plaintiff's counsel to produce an affidavit to that effect from Ms. Kawatachi.
Well, very much at issue as of the time of the hearing on the cross motions for summary judgment was whether Daimler Chrysler was a tortfeasor for UIM purposes, was it not?
It was. And we actually addressed that point in our reply memo, if I'm not right, possibly in our memorandum in opposition to the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. But we did introduce copies of the plaintiff's own pleadings in the underlying action to the contrary.
Well, can't the Young affidavit be read as implying that the plaintiffs were relying on representations of some kind, whether express or implied or whatever, on Liberty Mutual's part, that for purposes of prosecuting its UIM claim against Liberty Mutual, or their UIM claim against Liberty Mutual, Liberty Mutual would not regard Daimler Chrysler as a tortfeasor?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, but that simply is not supported by the record. There's nothing, no evidence whatsoever of any express or implied representation by Liberty Mutual. We cannot control what was in Mr. Young's mind, or how he was viewing the situation, or how he had evaluated what the prospects of an underinsured motorist claim would be.
And I didn't interrupt you, Mr. Fujimoto. I assume that the amount of UIM insurance was known to plaintiff's counsel at the time you folks gave the consent.
Correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct, because I believe at that time it was under the same policy in which the Richard Thomas liability claim had been settled as well, too.
And that amount was $640,000 total, $40,000 from another carrier and $600,000 from your folks. Can you tell me any practical or real reason why a plaintiff's lawyer would accept $200,000, which would possibly jeopardize, under your theory of the case, the $640,000 that they could easily have with the injuries that were in this case?
And yet, Your Honor, I don't know what was in Mr. Young's mind. All I know is that, like all of us, we are all charged with the applicable law at the time of the settlement. We cited the Geico versus Daisal case to plaintiff's counsel's office well before they finalized the settlement, 2 months before. In other words, we cited it in January of 2002, and I believe the settlement, the Daimler Chrysler settlement, was not finalized until March of 2002. They might have disagreed with us on the applicability of Geico versus Daisal. That might have been one reason, and they didn't feel that it was that much a barrier to the claim. So, in other words, they cannot say, oh, just because we're going to raise a defense that they would not have entered into the settlement. That type of reliance would not be reasonable under this court's prior decisions.
I have one more question. Following your theory of the case, let's assume the same facts with one exception, and that would be that rather than a products liability case against a motor vehicle manufacturer, that there is a claim of negligent maintenance or operation of the highway. Would the same theory apply as a credit, or you folks wouldn't have to pay if the state were self-insured? I mean, if like I was a plaintiff's lawyer and I accepted $1,000 from the state, would that get you folks off the hook, assuming the same facts?
Your Honor, I think as a matter of, as a hypothetical, I don't think it cannot ignore the fact that presently, by statute, and subject to this court's further determination on maybe on a subsequent appeal possibly, I believe there's no joint and several liability on the part of the state. So it will not necessarily apply to the state because as a matter of law, the state cannot be a joint tortfeasor under the current statutory framework. So if it would be back then, at that time, if it was sort of like the Kinker versus Bauer scenario, I would submit that assuming the state can be joint and several liable, then they would be in the same position that Daimler Chrysler is in this case, in the sense that, in that sense. But under the current law and under, for purposes of future cases and accidents after what my understanding would be, because I have never had this specific point in on an appeal, but after the effective date of the statutory amendment of last year, I believe that question would never arise because at that point in time, the state of Hawaii would not be a joint tortfeasor. Just to follow up on one prior point in response to your question, Your Honor, we did introduce evidence in the record below concerning the pleadings in the underlying action, and we would submit our admissions on the part of plaintiff that Daimler Chrysler was at least a tortfeasor, and in fact was a joint tortfeasor because of the way the alleged joint and several liability on the part of Daimler Chrysler. And specifically, their theories were, number one, that there was an inadequate warning associated with the Neon that the plaintiff was riding in at the time of the accident. And number two, there were design defects in that vehicle. And also, I would add that the plaintiff did in fact claim punitive damages against Daimler Chrysler in their first amended complaint as well as their first amended pretrial statement. Another reason, and following upon Mr. Young's affidavit and I believe some of the plaintiff's arguments in this case, is that Daimler Chrysler, they asserted, settled for a nuisance value of $200,000. I would submit it's a very dangerous proposition for once you get into calling any amount a nuisance value or not a nuisance value. In particular, I would note that this court recently, in its Brooks versus Dana Nance decision, basically determined that a $100,000 settlement was, quote, not insignificant. So I would submit that the plaintiff's argument that the Daimler Chrysler settlement and the ICA's rationale, quite frankly, that the Daimler Chrysler settlement might have been, quote, unquote, a nuisance value settlement in no way dilutes his status as a joint tortfeasor.
Counsel, when you refer to nuisance value, normally, I guess you would try to evaluate what the case is worth, what the entire value is of the case, right?
That's correct.
The settlement of this case was?
As I understand it, in the lower court proceedings before the payment of additional UIM monies, I believe it was over $1.6 million.
And looking at the sort of real value of the case, this was a settlement value, what was the potential?
It could have been higher. As I understood it, the plaintiff's injuries were quite severe. It probably was higher than that in the sense that, as I understood it, the plaintiff was paraplegic. And I think in terms of the value of her total damages, notwithstanding liability issues, as it were, then I believe it would have exceeded that amount.
Can you give me an idea as to what you guys were talking about in terms of full value?
I would not be able to do that, Your Honor, because I myself was not counsel of record in the underlying case. I did not do that sort of evaluation. I do know that there was, that the case was mediated extensively before Judge McConnell, and I believe collectively, in as much as Plaintiff Donna Zane herself was a passenger, I don't believe any contributory negligence, for example, would be attributable to them. So I thought that they probably tried to get within at least a range of the full value of the case. But I, so in answer to the court's question, I don't know that the full value of the case was that much more, because I believe the functional mediation, there was no discounting for liability factors because Ms. Zane was a passenger. It would, if anything, it would be various liability issues as between the defendants, who would bear the more proportionate share, as well as collectability issues, I suppose. But I think, and I know that there was a prior decision of this court that says that in and of itself, the settlement, prior settlement is quote-unquote evidence of the value of the case, and specifically a general damages only settlement. I believe the name of that case, if I'm not mistaken, was State Farm Insurance Company versus Dakane. And I believe in that case that, you know, it would be evidence that. So the only response I can have to the court's question would be to look at the, that, that value itself. And as of this date, given the additional monies that have been tendered, I believe it, the total amount that has been previously received by plaintiff is $1,690,000. Your Honor, unless the court has any further specific questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court. Let's start with waiver, because I think in this case, we need to back up to the controlling case, which is the Anoka case. Liberty Mutual has construed this as an estoppel case. The ICA decision talked about waiver and estoppel, but the actual circuit court ruling was waiver. Circuit court says, reading from transcript on page 32, I'm just saying, under the peculiar undisputed facts of this, the consent constituted not only a consent but also a waiver of any claim to a credit beyond $200,000. The use of the word...
Excuse me, Mr. Sakuda, let me interject a question which I think is sort of foundational to what you're leading up to. The plaintiffs concede, do they not, that the Taylor rule with respect to the credit or the gap would control but for Daimler Chrysler's lack of tortfeasor status?
No, the plaintiffs concede that the general rule of Taylor is that where, usually in an auto case because it's an underinsured motorist coverage, where the underinsured motorist policy limit is not exhausted, there is a credit. In our argument below, we said it didn't apply in this particular case for several reasons. Number one, the policy itself distinguished how you handle the policy limits of an underinsured motorist and of anybody else. As to the underinsured motorist, the policy is very specific. The policy says, and in this case, the underinsured motorist would have been Sarah Kim. The policy says that you must use, we will pay under this coverage only after the limits of liability under any applicable bodily injury liability bonds or policies have been exhausted by payment or judgment. That is in the insuring agreement dealing with underinsured motor vehicle.
Which is another way of framing, isn't it? The question whether Daimler Chrysler's unlimited BI self-insurance was applicable or not?
Well, no, because There is a separate section, that's A2. There is also section B. Under B1, B now applies to others, okay? And it says this, any amounts otherwise payable for damages under this coverage apply over and above all sums one. Paid by or on behalf of persons or organizations who may be legally responsible, okay? So the policy itself sets up
two categories. In other words, tortfeasors.
Correct, non-auto tortfeasors. But there, you don't get a credit for the policy limit, you get a credit for the amount paid. So the policy itself sets up that distinction, and it's a very important distinction because you don't need to reach issues of waiver or tortfeasor. But moving on to whether Chrysler was a tortfeasor or its policy was applicable, the cases are all unanimous that a non-liable person is not a tortfeasor. And the Hawaii cases are as well.
Daimler Chrysler, in your view, was a non-liable tortfeasor because why?
Because there was no viable theory of liability developed by any of the parties. In this case...
So what?
Because under Troyer, one is a tortfeasor only if there is liability, which under Troyer says you can sue and also recover. If there is no liability, you can sue, but you cannot recover. Therefore, you don't meet the definition of tortfeasor.
No. Was Daimler Chrysler adjudicated non-liable by anybody?
No. There was never an adjudication of actual legal liability of any of the parties because the matter was settled.
In fact, is it not the norm in the context of tendering UIM claims to a UIM insurer that there has been no formal adjudication of the liability of any tortfeasor?
Correct. There is normally no formal adjudication.
All right. And so on what basis then are we to determine as a matter of law that Daimler Chrysler was not a tortfeasor because there was no viable claim against it?
Because as the ICA has pointed out, it was undisputed that Judge McConnell negotiated, mediated a nuisance value settlement based on defense costs because none of the parties were able to develop a viable theory of liability against Daimler Chrysler. There is nothing in the record other than that.
Judge McConnell did not enter a finding that there was no viable claim against Daimler Chrysler, did he?
No, correct. The only evidence in the record dealing with that subject is the declaration of Keith Young, who goes through his discussions, the mediation process, his discussions with the carrier. That's the only evidence in the record.
Do you argue that there is a genuine issue of material fact as to whether Liberty Mutual understood that the plaintiffs were proceeding with its settlement of the underlying tort claim on the basis that Liberty Mutual was not going to regard Daimler Chrysler as a tortfeasor for UIM purposes?
No, I don't believe that there was a genuine issue of material fact. And the reason I say this is because if you turn to the motion for summary judgment filed by Liberty Mutual itself, it states on page 2, the following facts have been admitted and are undisputed for purposes of this motion. Okay? It lists a number of facts. If you turn to page 4, it gets to the UIM coverage. Paragraph N. Liberty Mutual initially accepted coverage, but refused to tender underinsured motorist benefits on the theory that, quote, it appears that Sarah Kim was not negligent for the bodily injuries sustained by Ms. Zane, as documented in its letter dated February 15, 2002. This is a judicial admission that they didn't deny it. They accepted the coverage, and the basis for their denial was that there was no liability on the part of the UIM driver. Not because there was a credit due under Taylor for Chrysler. And then they further state, paragraph R, Liberty Mutual consented to the liability settlement with Daimler Chrysler and may not now object to that settlement as a basis for denying underinsured motorist benefits. That's what the trial court was talking about when the trial court said, wait a minute, Liberty Mutual, you proceeded through this whole case from answer to your motion for summary judgment to your opposition to the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on the basis that there was no communication of any credit under Taylor until several days before the hearing. Then we have an affidavit declaration by the adjuster that says, I had a conversation with one of the plaintiff's attorneys in which I said, Taylor may apply, which then is totally undocumented. And all of that adjuster's communications and correspondence thereafter all talk about other reasons to deny. It asks for an extension of time to respond to the settlement proposal. If there's no payment due because of the Taylor credit, why would you ask for an extension of time? If there's no payment due, why would you then respond that we're denying on the basis that the UIM driver is not negligent? Why would you even...
Liberty Mutual was the BI carrier for which defendant?
For Richard Thomas. That's the driver in which Zane was the passenger.
Richard Thomas was also a UIM motorist, was he not?
No, because...
Potentially.
Because under the Kang decision, you don't get UIM from the car you're in if you already got liability, unless you're a resident relative or insured. So under the Kang decision, Richard Thomas would not be the UIM driver, but Sarah Kim would be the UIM driver. And that's why specifically the Liberty Mutual denial says that they're denying because it appears that Sarah Kim was not negligent as opposed to Richard Thomas.
Now, when did Liberty Mutual throw in Sarah Kim's policy limit?
Liberty Mutual threw in Richard Thomas's policy limit, which was $1.35 million. And at that point in time, Liberty Mutual had a cross-claim against Daimler Chrysler, and it dropped its cross-claim. Okay. Liberty Mutual at that point, with that sort of financial stake, had every financial incentive to pursue that cross-claim if there was a viable theory of liability. Under Finley and Del Monte, Liberty Mutual's counsel had the duty and obligation to pursue any viable theories against other tortfeasors in defense of Richard Thomas. And yet, Liberty Mutual abandoned their claim with no payment. Because everybody agreed after discovery, not initially, everyone filed claims initially, but after discovery, there simply panned out no viable theory to pursue.
At some point, Kim's insurer tendered policy limits, and they were accepted.
Correct. Both auto liability, BI liability carriers tendered policy limits.
That was before January 8th, 2002.
Correct.
When was that?
That was as part of the mediation that Judge McConnell conducted.
Was it subsequent to the mediation that Judge McConnell conducted and the settlement of the underlying tort claims that Liberty Mutual took the position that it was denying UIM on the basis that Kim was not liable?
Yes, the BI claims all settled first for the drivers, and then a subsequent, at that point, Chrysler refused to settle because of no liability. So Judge McConnell went back for a second session with Chrysler only because Liberty Mutual and State Farm had tendered their limits. After Chrysler then agreed to a nuisance value settlement, that's when Young talked to the carriers, both carriers, and said, look, this is what's happening. And Young's affidavit is not that go ahead and process the rights to UIM under your normal claim process. Young's affidavit...
What I'm asking right now is whether Liberty Mutual persisted in its position that Kim had no liability even after State Farm tendered Kim's policy.
Correct. State Farm tendered Kim's policy in 2001. And into 2002, Liberty Mutual was still saying, we are not going to pay UIM benefits because we don't believe Kim was negligent. But getting back to my original theory, see, what's important about waiver and estoppel is that with waiver is a unilateral doctrine under ANOCA. It requires no prejudice. It requires no reliance by the plaintiff. All it is it focuses on the conduct of the insurer. And if you look at what Liberty Mutual urged on the court as the undisputed facts upon which this motion for summary judgment should be decided, then waiver is appropriate because Liberty Mutual itself said, yes, we accepted the UIM claim coverage. And then it said, our consenting to the underlying Chrysler settlement is such that we cannot use it as a basis for denying UIM benefits. Their theory through the entire case was, despite that, as a matter of law, the Taylor credit kicked in no matter what they did. And the court said, wait a minute, you waived it. The conduct of waiver is clear, because the conduct of waiver is that they accepted the coverage. They said the driver wasn't negligent. They consented to it, to the underlying settlement, and agreed that they couldn't use that, the underlying settlement, as a basis to now deny benefits. And they also sent a number of confirming letters.
I'm sorry, Liberty Mutual accepted that Kim was not negligent?
No, what Liberty Mutual accepted Liberty Mutual, this is, comes from the Liberty Mutual memorandum in support of its own motion for summary judgment, that these are the undisputed facts that the court should apply. Liberty Mutual initially accepted coverage, but refused to tender UIM benefits on the theory that it appears Sarah Kim was not negligent. It admits that it accepted the coverage, and the only reason it refused to tender was because the UIM carrier was, the UIM driver was not negligent. It didn't refuse because of the Taylor coverage. Nowhere in any of their papers, their answer, their pretrial statements, the motion for summary judgment, their opposition to plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, nowhere was it ever mentioned that they were going to assert the Taylor credit. This concept that they...
does the record establish as a matter of law that Liberty Mutual had represented in any fashion that it would not assert the Taylor credit?
Yes, I believe that paragraph N, that Liberty Mutual accepted coverage but refused to tender benefits on the basis that the UIM driver was not negligent, can be read reasonably to say that, yes, this was our defense. We had agreed that we would defend only on the merits of the UIM claim.
Is there a genuine issue of material fact as to what Liberty Mutual meant by that?
I think reading just the admissions and for now ignoring the declarations of both Young and the adjuster, the answer would be no, that there is sufficient undisputed evidence that was urged upon the court to form the basis of its decision to support the trial court's finding of waiver. If the question is, once you add the declarations, are there some factual inconsistencies? I think, Your Honor, the answer is yes, but those inconsistencies...
With waiver sort of in artful, do you think the circuit court really meant judicially estopped, that having taken an initial position that it was denying UIM benefits on the grounds that the UIM driver was not negligent, it could not thereafter change its position as to why it was not tendering UIM benefits because parties had reasonably relied to their detriment on it?
No, because that was that concept of prejudice and reliance and changing of positions never came up. Because remember, until then, there was never an issue of changing positions.
Well, then I guess my question is how it can be that a carrier waives positions Y and Z because it, in the first instance, advances position X?
Because a waiver can be implied as well as expressed, and we have conduct implying consistent with Young's declaration that there would be no subtraction for the insurance or self-insurance limits that Chrysler had, and that there would be payment of UIM benefits. That's what's critical about the Young affidavit, because it says without prejudicing Zane's right to payment of UIM benefits, and that to this day is unrebutted. It is undisputed. What has to be kept in context is Young's affidavit declaration comes first. The adjuster Chan's declaration comes after that, and when Chan's declaration comes, it never disputes anything Young said. In fact, to this date, Liberty Mutual has offered no explanation whatsoever that if in fact Chan said, we're not going to pay because of a Taylor credit, why Chan then thereafter, the adjuster, sent letters asking for an extension? It doesn't make time. Sent a letter saying, we're not going to pay because the UIM driver wasn't negligent. That doesn't make any sense either. Well,
why would Chang have sent to plaintiff's counsel the Dysol decision?
Chang never sent to plaintiff's counsel the Dysol decision. What Chang's affidavit actually says, is that he had a telephone conversation with one of the counsel, and he told Ms. Kawatachi that offset discussed in Geico v. Dysol case may be applicable to Ms. Zane's claim, and Ms. Kawatachi said that she would research the case and get back to him. Okay? What's very, very troubling about this declaration is that it doesn't say, I told Ms. Kawatachi we were asserting the Taylor versus Geico offset so we don't have to pay you. It says may be applicable, and then is totally inconsistent with everything this adjuster does and puts in writing thereafter. Plaintiffs never understood that Liberty Mutual was going to assert a Taylor credit. That's why the initial discussion occurred before we took the Chrysler Daimler settlement. That's why AIG paid its money. That was the understanding. And there is nothing in this declaration by the adjuster that disputes that. Nothing.
Part of Judge Hefo's oral ruling was that the purpose of getting the consent, by which I take to mean the purpose of the plaintiffs soliciting and obtaining Liberty Mutual's consent, which was made known to Liberty Mutual, was so that the credit would not kick in.
Correct.
What do you understand that to mean?
I understand that to mean the Daimler Chrysler credit, because all the other policy limits had been tendered, so there was no credit issue with any of the other limits, any of the other policies. The only issue was with the Daimler Chrysler.
And no one's argued to the court, and the court does not find, that even if you are entitled to the credit, that you can't give it up. And the court finds that they, presumably meaning Liberty Mutual, did.
Correct.
What do you take that to mean?
I take that to mean waiver, as the court in the end said, I find that Liberty Mutual waived the credit.
So, oh, the court found that Liberty Mutual waived. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The court says, I'm just saying under the peculiar undisputed facts of this, the consent constituted not only a consent, but also a waiver of any claim to a credit beyond $200,000. So that was the court's reasoning below.
So the court entered findings of fact.
No, this is the transcript.
Well, I'm looking at pages 31 and 32. And no one's argued to the court, and the court does not find that even if you are entitled to the credit, that you can't give it up. And the court finds that they did. Isn't that a finding of fact?
Yes.
In other words, isn't the court weighing the evidence and affording it the weight and effect to which the court determined it to be entitled, and then entering findings of fact on that basis?
Not in the context of the way the court said that, because no one has disputed it. So in that sense, it's not weighing disputed facts and picking one over the other. It's simply saying, because nobody has disputed it, this is what the court is finding, that there was
a
waiver.
In the hearing, Liberty Mutual, however belatedly in your view, was arguing that we're entitled to the benefit of the Taylor credit, and nothing we said or did up to this point prevents us from benefiting from the Taylor credit, and your position was that's all wrong. And here's the litany of conduct that you've engaged in and representations that you've made that establish that you have waived. And Judge Hefo heard all of that, and Judge Hefo found that Liberty Mutual had waived.
You could look at it that way. The judge also talked about basing her decision on the judicial admissions that Liberty Mutual made. And if you simply look at the undisputed judicial admissions that...
What admission other than that in the first instance it was Liberty Mutual was denying UIM coverage on the basis that Kim was not negligent?
And the admission that they could not use the Daimler-Chrysler settlement as a basis to deny UIM benefits. Because as the court below said, what else could that mean in the context of this case? It couldn't mean anything else because everyone else had paid the policy limits.
Isn't that a way, or could that not be construed as a way of saying, we're fully aware of Taylor v. Geico. We understand that a UIM carrier is entitled to the credit of the difference, or in the amount of the difference between the settlement amount and policy limits. We understand that, and so the fact that you're settling with Daimler Chrysler doesn't alter the Taylor rule. Couldn't the statement be construed to mean that?
No, because it says it can't use a settlement as a basis. Okay. The only basis they have for saying that there's a gap is by using the settlement amount. If you take that away, there is simply no basis to find that there is a Taylor credit applicable. And that's the way the case was litigated from day one, because you have to understand, these admissions were made before the adjuster's declaration. Had the adjuster's declaration come first, obviously, these admissions wouldn't have been made. But that's the theory that this case proceeded from day one until a few days before the motion for summary judgment hearing. Everyone accepted that the Taylor credit had never been conveyed to the plaintiffs. The first time that's even mentioned anywhere is in the declaration of Chang on the reply memo several days before the hearing. That's the first time. Otherwise, the case went through its entire course with nobody ever asserting or suggesting that the Taylor credit was communicated in any fashion to the plaintiffs.
So in the end, whether Daimler Chrysler was a tortfeasor or not is really neither here nor there, isn't that so?
No, I mean, it still applies, because if Daimler Chrysler is not a tortfeasor, then its policy is not applicable.
So Daimler Chrysler was a tortfeasor?
No, Daimler Chrysler wasn't a tortfeasor.
Because?
Because the definition of a tortfeasor is one who has committed a tort, and in this particular case, the unanimous consensus between Zane, Liberty Mutual, and State Farm in the liability case was that there was no viable theory that Daimler Chrysler had committed a tort, and therefore no viable theory of liability. If they're not liable, then under the definition of tort, joint tortfeasor in 663.11 and under...
There was no stipulation among those parties that Daimler Chrysler was not a tortfeasor, was there?
No formal stipulation, but the simple abandoning of the claims, I think, speaks for itself.
Mrs. Quitta, when you mentioned the McConnell mediation to settle after the BI limits were tendered, what is the evidence that he focused on the cost of defense, the cost of defense experts, and so forth?
It's the, on page 7 of the ICA decision is the Young affidavit that the...
Where is this page 7 and 1?
Of the ICA decision. Okay. The best that Judge McConnell could accomplish was a mediated settlement consisting of a nuisance value payment of $200,000 by Daimler Chrysler, which represented an estimate of attorney's fees, expert witness fees, and expenses of litigation. And to this day, that remains undisputed and unrebutted.
Well, what about the question I asked Mr. Fujimura regarding the value of the case? The settlement was $1,600,000 or whatever.
Correct. 1.65 is the ultimate settlement. In this case, we're dealing with an 18-year-old, healthy, paraplegic. I mean, we were clearly dealing with millions, and not just one or two. Had there been higher policy limits on the vehicles or a viable theory of liability against Chrysler, this case would have gone into the millions and not just 1.6. And I think everyone being familiar and experienced with these types of cases, I think we would all agree with it. I don't think that would be disputed, that with no comparative liability issues, this case is worth way more than 1.6 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fujimura. How much time?
Yeah, and I won't take more than those 9 minutes, Your Honor. First off, I do need to clarify the record on a couple points. Number one, we filed, you know, as our initial pleading in this case, an answer and a counterclaim. The counterclaim is specifically requested relief pursuant to Taylor versus Geico and Geico versus Diazol in terms of the offsets, number one. Number two, we actually pled in our answer the defenses of accord and satisfaction, credit, set off, and offset to the extent appropriate under the circumstances of this case. So for Mr. Sakuda to contend that we didn't raise Taylor versus Geico or Geico versus Diazol during this action up until our reply memo is not supported by the record, because we did raise it as part of our initial pleadings. That was our fundamental contention throughout this case. Now, a lot has been focused upon in terms of our memorandum in support of our motion that, in the specific language, because I think it got clouded as Mr. Sakuda's argument went on, but the specific language is Liberty Mutual consented to the liability settlement with Daimler Chrysler and may not now object to that settlement as a basis for denying underinsured benefits. And what I made very clear to the circuit court below and what I maintain now, and I would confirm, Liberty Mutual has never and still does not object to the settlement. Our position, however, is that its refusal to object, its consent to settlement, whatever you want to call it, under the applicable law, does not prevent it from asserting offset issues, because it's comparing apples and oranges, two different things. Again, to object to the settlement, that would come into play for subrogation rights. So the only thing a consent to settlement or a not objecting to a settlement would implicate would be a waiver of subrogation rights.
Mr. Fujimoto, what do you make of Mr. Sakuda's argument that Liberty Mutual's initial basis for denying UIM coverage was its position that Sarah Kim was not negligent, and his suggestion that Liberty Mutual never backed off that position.
To this day, Your Honor, obviously, we went into declaratory judgment action with legal issues pursuant to offsets. We still maintain the right and dispute the right to contest the amount of Sarah Kim's liability for purposes, and we always have maintained that. But I think as the court pointed out in its earlier questions to Mr. Sakuda, and specifically under this court's Imoka decision, a denial on ground X does not prevent an insurer from going to Y and Z. And we have a number of defenses in this case, the offset and the credit being one of them. We also have these issues as to liability as well as to the amount of damages, as well as the evidence of the settlement itself being evidence of the plaintiff's damages. So we do have reserve those rights.
Mr. Fujimoto, does your insurance policy differentiate between motor vehicle insurance and other insurance, as Mr. Sakuda represented?
Your Honor, he did quote the provisions on our policy. There's one provision that he did not mention, and that is said that any insurance with respect to a vehicle you do not own shall be excess to all other collectible insurance, and that's specifically another insurance provision. So, and again, looking at all of the context in this case, and specifically given the way this court held in Taylor, that is, we invalidate such an exhaustion clause, any exhaustion clauses or other insurance clause. In other words, it's not preventing a plaintiff from asserting a UIM claim. However, we will give the UIM insurer a credit and an offset for the gap. And
that's the amount paid, is that correct?
Between the amount paid and the amount that is available and amount foregone. That was specifically the holding of Taylor, and that was what was, and I would commend the Geico versus Dizal decision to this court's review, because I believe its analysis is sound, not only based on the Taylor versus Geico decision, but on the EIG versus Rutledge decision too. So, and if, for the court's reference, I believe several copies were attached by both sides in the record on appeal of the Geico versus Dizal decision, so it should be accessible to the court. Okay, lastly, Your Honor, there was a lot of reliance on Judge McConnell. In this case, Judge McConnell was not an arbitrator. He was not a judge. He was a retired judge acting as a mediator. By definition, his function was not to adjudicate any liability issues. So the fact that Judge McConnell was only able to, quote unquote, negotiate a settlement, again, in no way diminishes Daimler Chrysler's status as a tortfeasor.
Liberty Mutual have a claim against Chrysler?
No, we did not. And actually, that is an overgeneralization. And I should have addressed this in my opening argument, but I'm glad the court raised the question. Liberty Mutual was never a party to the underlying tort lawsuit.
Thomas.
Thomas had asserted a cross-claim, but as part of the settlement process, they resolved that. But I believe the court's Granger decision addresses that point. In Granger, USA and Liberty Mutual in the context of this case was as USAA was in the Granger decision. And specifically in a footnote, this court in its Granger decision held that the lower court had, quote, no jurisdiction over USAA as in its capacity as a liability insurer for the defense. In this case, Liberty Mutual is a UIM insurer asserting a right to a credit and an offset. So you cannot mix up those capacities, and you cannot transform Liberty Mutual into a party to the underlying lawsuit. And I would submit that's directly belied by this court's holding in the Granger case, and as well as I believe in the Botsero versus McMillan case as well too.
Mr. Fujimoto, the statement was actually, I think Thomas was the party that claimed against Chrysler?
Yeah, there was a cross-claim asserted in the case, and it was settled as part of the underlying settlement.
It was settled how?
I believe through the stipulated dismissal process.
I guess the question is, did Thomas or their counsel, and that's the remutual, I guess, right? The remutual believed that there was a claim against, a viable claim against Chrysler.
Your Honor, this is the thing. The case, underlying case was settled. Thomas basically settled that case. Liberty Mutual, in its capacity as defending Thomas in that case, for in the interests of Thomas's insured, settled that case.
Thomas had a legitimate Rule 11 basis for asserting a cross-claim against Daimler Chrysler?
Correct. Correct. And because, again, and it was based on the, if the initial First Amendment complaint or initial complaints in this case, or the First Amendment complaint had Rule 11 basis, then clearly Thomas would have had a basis too, because it all it did was assert a derivative contribution indemnity claim against Daimler Chrysler as a co-defendant. It would be a standard cross-claim.
And so the policy limits that were paid by Thomas was how much?
I believe it was $600,000.
And so theoretically, he could have gone forward to collect that from.
It was more. Oh, okay, I might be mistaken. Then,
one point.
I would defer to the briefing on that.
So theoretically, he could have gone forward with the case, the cross claim against the Chrysler, and better collect that amount on indemnification.
If that was the situation, but again, that's apples, because that's the liability phase of the case. That's a separate lawsuit to which Liberty Mutual is not a party itself.
I'm just trying to determine whether or not there was or was not, as
the point. But I believe that the premise of the settlement of the underlying case was a global settlement as well, too, among all of the defendants. And so, for example, if Richard Thomas had wanted to preserve a cross-claim, that might have jeopardized the settlement in its entirety. And obviously, that would be something that would be contrary to public policy.
I see. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you for allowing us to be heard today.
Thank you.
Thank you.